ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this next session. This is an extended session on securing the user. We're going to start with a presentation by Professor Angela Sass on understanding user behavior and motivations. And then that's going to be followed by a panel discussion on practical tactics to change user behavior and create a secure culture.
Thanks, Victoria. So I want to set the scene for the challenge that we face in terms of securing a modern organization. And I actually changed my slides slightly this morning because I felt, you know, I wanted to actually be a bit more straightforward about it and saying, like, you know, securing the user, what does it take to do it? I think change the security professional is the first step. So stay with me to see if you agree with me at the end. So I am, apart from being a professor at UCL, I'm the director of the UK Research Institute in Science of Cybersecurity, which is one of these funny institutions, which is partly funded by the people who normally fund research and partly funded by GCHQ, or now the NCSC. So it's really a UK-wide collection of researchers who work on the same similar sort of topic, which is organizational security, how to measure its effectiveness, and particularly anything to do with human behavior and security is very much in our space. So I really here represent what is now a collection of about 40, 50 UK academics who work in this space and who meet regularly with staff from the NCSC, but also with practitioners to discuss what the problems on the ground are, what knowledge we can apply, and so on. So I think the mission statement makes it really clear. So this is not ivory tower research. This is real world security problems we focus on. And it's really we're trying to our brief compared to the other research institutes is to look at this intersection between threats to information and threats to people and organizations. And we work with, we've really identified that it's not just about the end users, but the roles played by various other stakeholders, the security specialists, but also developers, implementers, policymakers, also regulators, contribute something towards the problems that we're trying to tackle here. We promote an active and collaborative engagement approach, meaning we have a practitioner panel. We invite interested practitioners to come to the meetings to comment on our research, but also to tell us what they think the most urgent problems are to tackle. And if they're so inclined, also to work with us to offer us test beds for trying interventions that we think are promising. We're now in our first phase. We're mostly funded by what's now the National Cybersecurity Center. But I wanted to talk about some of the key outcomes we've had from phase one and now phase two. So one of the ones you may have come across in the meantime is the new password policy that GCHQ issued nearly 2 years ago, and which is you'll now find on the NCSC website as this is the official government advice on how you should manage passwords. And when it came out, it caused a bit of a few raised eyebrows and so on, because it said that a lot of the previous policy of what was taken as gospel, such as you must make passwords as strong as possible, you know, you should change them regularly to improve security, to actually changing it to the perspective that really we have established as part of the risks research, which is that if you want effective security, you can't just, it doesn't mean, you know, the strongest policies, the strongest measures, the more you get people to do, that's how you get effective security. It's very, very clear that this is not working, that if you're asking too much of people in terms of security, it becomes counterproductive. So very, very much here, the emphasis of this new policy is the service providers, the people who are owning systems and who are setting up the authentication mechanism, should take the main responsibility, right? It's utterly pointless to ask people to have strong passwords if you then don't secure the password file adequately, right? Also acknowledge that most passwords are not stolen through by passwords being cracked. You know, they're stolen through spyware, through phishing, and so on. And however strong your password was, you know, or if a password file is leaked, it doesn't matter how strong your password was. It's gone, right? The attackers have it. It doesn't offer you no protection. So that shift in thinking is I think, slowly happening. And what we're seeing is, you know, it's going to be a slow process because even organizations where the security staff have read this guidance and are trying to implement it are then facing auditors who come up to them and say, oh, no, but you must expire a password, right? Surely, you know, not doing so is bad security, and so on. And at Cyber UK in March this year, basically several people from organizations reported that back and said, like, so what do we say to the auditors? And I think really the NCSC staff are really now finding themselves into the role of saying, like, well, tell them to come to us. We are the national technical authority. And if they have a problem with our guidance, they should take it up with us. Now, and I think if you've been following what they're doing, they've been explaining various part of the policies, you know, why do we think so through blog styles and so on. And I think we are actually entering a new phase here of actually a much more collaborative approach, and really, you know, it's rather than dictating policies from the top down and their push down. This is really what I want to make clear is if we want effective security, it needs to be more collaborative and it needs to be more of a negotiation. And really actually having that discussion to figure out what really works in practice. And then having, you know, if we want effective solutions, that's what we need. So password policy was one key outcome. The other part that happened at Cyber UK this year was that one of the NCSC staff who is the lead, the NCSC has a socio-technical security team now, which is over a dozen strong. So they've actually built, as a result of the things they've learned from working with the Risks Institute, is they've basically just learned how important it is to really make security work in organizations and really help organizations regain control. So they've now got a team working, and those are the people who you see blogging on these various new policies. So they're also, so MRW, who is the lead, stood up and basically said, it's now official government policy. You're not allowed to say people are the weakest link anymore, right? Forget it, right? This is, it's counterproductive, it's not working anymore, you know, so from now on, officially, the mantra is people are the strongest link. And I think that was basically like, got like a yay from about a quarter of the audience and a very sharp intake of breath from the other 1,500 people in the room who basically going like, what does that mean, right? What does that, you know, how do I do something about it, you know? So the motto is, if security doesn't work for people, it doesn't work. And they're emphasizing there is this need to reshape the relationship between the IT security team in an organization and the people who use IT security. Of course, you know, basically I've been working in doing research in this area for 20 years. From my point of view, it was almost like, oh, great, I can sit back now. My work is done, right? They finally got it. But, of course, it really means the work is now beginning because we now have to account for, so what does that mean? What are we telling security specialists they should be doing for working with users? And so that's basically what I want to talk about. And I think there is a real need to do it because meanwhile, on a LinkedIn group, you know, happening at exactly the same time, this is actually the cybersecurity awareness or the security awareness group. Basically, somebody came up with this comment, what's the biggest vulnerability in organization? And I thought like, oh my God, I bet I know what's coming, right? And you know, people, employees, you know, homo sapiens, you know, people, the human factor, and it goes on. You know, even though I waded in quite early on and I said, guys, you know, how about unworkable policies, bad technology, and security experts who just don't want to acknowledge that there is a problem, right? And then somebody goes like, oh, yes, but we can train people, right? And I'm going like, no, awareness and education can't help fixing security. That doesn't work. And it just went on and on. They completely took notice of what I said, you know, and it's basically bash, bash, bash. And I think that's actually really that illustrates, you know, why we need this shift, basically saying like, you know, you're not allowed to say that anymore. It's very nice if security experts can bond by basically going and bashing, you know, a common enemy there. You know, it might make you feel good for a bit, sort of, it relieves the tension. Yes, great. But it really, it's counterproductive. It doesn't help us to change and go towards better ones, you know. So really, I did a sort of quick tally, about 400 responses to this, like in, you know, in 90% the answer was it's the user, it's the people, and stupidity, which is, of course, assigned to the people, you know, and really very little acknowledgement that other things are the problem. So how do we make security work for people if we're trying to work our way out of this now? So I want to introduce a handy three-step primer for doing that. And one of the reasons, basically, of course, I have a lot more steps, but I also know that if you're trying to change behavior of people in an organization who also still have a day job to do, trying to do more than three things at the same time is not going to work. And so I want to start with the basics here and then discuss with you whether, with the panel and with you later on, whether you think that actually are the first three steps we should be taking. So the first one is you have to really adjust your perspective as a security expert. Security is your main job, you know, you love it, you're very passionate about it, and you want to see it succeed. But you are the only people in the world for whom it is the main job. For everybody else, they have another main job to do, and what you're asking them to do for security has to fit into their tasks, and it has to fit into the organization, the business processes. So, and I think really security people have to acknowledge that and basically say, I can't just say, oh, here is, you know, threat A, so I'm going to do policy B and countermeasure C, completely irrespective of who is, you know, what the people are doing, whether they are brain surgeons or whether they're working on a checkout or whatever. You know, that just can't be right. You need to fit the security solution into the business, into the working environment, into the individual task. Now, I will actually give you one really important point is you can't actually do this by yourself. On another line of basically trying to get this change happening is to get the leaders in the business, to get boards in bigger organizations or the owners in smaller organizations to actually realize that they have to help you with this job, right? They are the experts on what really makes the business tick, what really makes it profitable, you know, what makes you competitive. And so they should discuss with you what the risks are, what are the options for managing those risks, and which of those fit best into the way we work, right? So if they basically just say like, oh, you know, security, you know, headache, go and fix it, that's really not fair on security people. They really need that support and they need that engagement. They need the time. So, but really, I think it's very, very helpful to always think when you're choosing security measures. You know, don't just choose what the manual says or what everybody else are. You know, we need to be prepared to change. We're looking for efficient methods in security. Otherwise, we are just all going to be choked by, you know, spending far too much time on various security measures. So when people are spending time and effort on it, the first thing is really this got to be worthwhile, right? You've got to get a good risk management payback for that. And if you can get payback for other aspects of the business, that could be even better. So I want to basically highlight a couple of my real bête noirs in this space. So, you know, we're basically popping up security warnings, you know, which we know from usability literature from 25 years ago is a really bad idea, right? Disrupting people's activity by popping up boxes. And then particularly if they go like, so what do I do now? You know, do I pack up and go home? Or, you know, because there's really no action for me. And that, basically, so it's a bad mechanism to start with. And then on top of that, we've got, with a lot of the warnings, you've got incredibly high false positive rates. And we know from human factors literature, 50 years old, is that if you have a false positive rate higher than 5%, people will start ignoring the warning, right? I mean, that's very, very, very well known. And yet, we have basically like stuff like HTTPS warnings, right? Popping up left, right, and center. And in 2013, it was basically established the false positive rate was over 15,000 to one. So if you looked at the warnings popped up, there was one genuine one for over 50. I'm sorry, that is dysfunctional. Whoever thought that was a good idea to deploy it, who took any responsibility for basically monitoring whether this mechanism was working and kept pushing it. And it's really not until in the last few years, several researchers have basically pointed out that this is really just, you're just conditioning people to ignore all security warnings, left, right, and center, right? They're basically now just don't take them seriously anymore. You know, from their point of view, it's like, you know, also they can't really understand most of the instructions, you know. So any warning comes up now, you know, basically people just go like, oh, it's technical crap, right? You know, and they learn very quickly that if you say, okay, go away and carry on, you know, as far as they can tell, there's no negative consequences. So so now we've basically conditioned billions of users to really, really disregard any warnings we give. It's not a good place to be. And then there's sometimes, I don't want to just say that it's the security experts are making mistakes here and the researchers are brilliant. There's also a whole bunch of researchers out there who are really doing pretty silly stuff, like some colleagues at Google who argued that, oh, if we just hide the OK button three levels down and we make it look really unattractive, you know, maybe people will pay attention to the warnings. But that's not the point, right? The point is that you have no course of action of where to go and do things, you know? But they're like saying is, you know, they really shouldn't ignore warnings and we'll just make them pay attention. Or some other researchers who basically using an fMRI scanner basically figured out that if you keep changing the warning all the time, right, you basically change the size of the box and the text and the colors and whatever, you can basically force people to not habituate, i.e. not just go like, oh, okay, I'm not reading this anymore, you know, just click on. I can make them pay attention for about 13 times, you know, and then I'm going like, okay, and after the 13 times, what else? Electroshocks, you know? You know, this is not the problem. The problem is that it's a dysfunctional, you know, that it's not really a functional security mechanism because it's just not an accurate warning. And to insist that people should pay attention to it is, you know, it's just not working. You know, it could basically, I have a whole list of other ones, but I'll move on in the interest of time. So my second part of the primer is complexity and vagueness are the enemy, right? Actually, most people aren't as careless and basically going like, oh, you know, I really don't care about security. I've been interviewing people in organizations and people at home for two decades now, right? And there is basically very few people who really don't care. It's just that they basically say, I can't pay attention to this anymore when they're overloaded or when they're feeling that their experience is they're being told to do stuff that then doesn't work, you know, or then they find out they've been made to do things that really doesn't offer them any protection. That's when they become cynical and disaffected. And if you're now trying to get through to them and say like, okay, look, you know, we've cleaned house, you know, we've got good security mechanisms and we're help, and if you follow these, you know, that would be a good thing. You've got to give that advice in a simple and concrete format. You know, I think a lot of the stuff that's being sent out, I mean, if you read that, you know, following the WannaCry, you know, this is basically came out from a university IT department to all staff. I let you get, you know, it's not going to be very hard to guess who the culprit here is, given where my main place of work is. you know, we urge you to be vigilant, not open emails that are unexpected, unusual, or suspicious in any way. If you experience any unusual behavior, especially any warning, you know, contact your IT support immediately. Right? I mean, this would be like 5,000 people, you know, sitting there and staring at the screen for most of the day and trying to dial the support, you know, the constantly engaged IT support hotline. Right? The whole organization would grind to a halt if you know, there's really nothing sensible and actionable in that advice. Right? Or, as the register pointed out, you know, if the police basically sends you advice about how to deal with WannaCry in an attachment entitled ransomware.pdf, right? I mean, given everything you've told users about what is suspicious and what shouldn't do, I mean, honestly, you know, this is really, you know, this is not helping. This is confusing people. We've got to find clear ways of communicating, and we've got to have standard mechanisms of how we get legitimate advice to people. We've got to whittle down the number of sources of information, tell people where the trustworthy, authoritative ones are, you know, rather than everybody piling in and wanting to play, I've unkindly called them Keystone Cyber Cops, you know, in this space of where, you know, arguably the best advice would be is here's the NCSC website, you know, it's up to date, it's authoritative, and it's the best advice we have in this country. Okay, so my third point is that security awareness and education, I very often hear that when I say, you know, this is not working, people can't do this, people, you know, it's not realistic. Sometimes I get like, ooh, couldn't we just do some more awareness and education or whatever? Well, I mean, the first thing to know about security awareness and education, it just wastes more of your staff's time. Right? If they're already struggling and can't use the security mechanisms that you're giving them, then saying like, ooh, but I'm going to make you sit through going through some web pages and reading stuff, explaining to you why I think you should be paying attention to this, you know, and how scary it is all out there, and that really, you know, you shouldn't ever click on anything that's in any way suspicious, and right? I mean, you're just wasting more of people's time. So we need to fix, you know, and make security workable first, and then we can embark on the journey of undoing all these bad habits that people have acquired in the past sort of decade or so. So really what you want is, you know, you don't just want get information to people, you want them to change risky behaviors that they're doing, right? You want them to stop doing the risky things and following the good secure practices. That isn't a quick fix. You know, that's not something you're going to achieve by sending out a few emails or by making people work through some web pages. It's basically a process that takes time. You know, dismantling highly learned behaviors and replacing them with new ones is a serious business, and it's not for amateurs. You know, so if you've not been trained on how to change behaviors and how to change organizational behaviors, I think it's a bit unrealistic. You know, and if you've never had any training on human behavior and then what goes on in people's heads, you know, don't think you're going to need help from professionals to do this. We pointed this out in the risks white paper on security, where we said, you know, security awareness, telling people there are risks out there and telling them that their behavior might actually enable some of those risks, getting their attention, that's only the first step. Then there is another six steps you need to go through in order to change the behavior, because changing a highly learned behavior is effort, right? And I mean, this is basically, this comes from originally from colleagues at HP, it's the maturity awareness curve. And so, you know, they yes, you need to get the information to them, but then they also need to accept that this is important, it's something they should pay attention to, and basically consider changing their behavior, you know, and then once they have accepted that they understand why it's necessary, they're motivated, then you still need to help them through that phase where the highly learned behavior is always the first reaction to a cue, and to get them to accept that they need to invest some time and effort to undo those habits and replace them with new ones. I think if you go around the exhibition here and so on, you'll see lots of examples of various kinds of tools and new training things. I think there are a lot of ideas around of things you can employ in that process to change people's behavior, to convince them, but also to make that process a bit, you know, make security seem more interesting and fun. There's lots of things around, and I think that's great, you know. I've actually seen that, you know, how you can get a bunch of school kids who didn't want to know suddenly really interested by giving them a game like Doxed. I've seen in organizations that when you play a physical game, like a board game, they call them arena games, where the threats are explained and they have to figure out what the correct behaviors are. And then something really great happens is staff start talking to each other about security. I think that really is, you know, if we can achieve that, then half the battle is won. You know, people actually start to accept it is something that affects their daily activities and it affects the company, and they accept that they have a role in it. And the more they talk to each other about it, you know, the more you'll actually get that engagement and you'll get staff to work with you. So we can get a lot more creative in this space, you know. And I think, but you have to always see that none of these things is going to be the one thing that's going to fix staff behavior. They are tools in the overall process, right? So it's very tempting to think, you know, ideas like nudge are kicking around, you know. So could we pop up a message to basically saying like, you know, I don't know, you know, 85% of your colleague have already updated their software or whatever, you know, so wouldn't it be time for you to be a good citizen and do the thing? Yes, again, that kind of thing can, within the overall approach that you're taking, that can actually play a role. But please don't think that one of those things alone is going to take care of the problem in itself. And I think coming back to my very first point is also, if you don't go and clean up your security measures beforehand, if you're just basically going like, oh, but I want people to do this, I want people to do that, you know, but the kind of nudges only work if actually the nudger, i.e. you, who are trying to change the behavior, and the nudgee, the person who you're trying to get change behavior, actually agree about where in the long term you want to be, right? That they actually agree this new behavior is the right thing, and that they want to go there, then these kind of reminders and nudges can help. But not if they actually don't agree with you. And I would actually argue that a lot of choices we're offering people at the moment, whether that's as employees or as consumers and citizens out there, they're more like this kind of choice, right? Where basically two people come into a rental car business and they say there's only two left. One is the murder car, so one in six people gets killed. And the other one is a regular car, but it's got a GPS that's stuck trying to tell you to go to Seattle, right? So it's very clear, I mean, what the safer, the more secure option is to take the car with a GPS, right? But it's bloody annoying. And so, very shortly they come back afterwards and say, we'll take the murder car. Because, I just can't cope with, you know, this thing that's telling me the whole time, you know, I should be going somewhere else. And I think a lot of security tools at the moment, we need to get over that. We need to clean house and really have effective, workable security measures before we can basically start nudging and directing people towards that. So, really, in order to work out what works for your organization, for the people that you're responsible for, is I always get like Jean, you know, I think Jean-Luc Picard, and it's not just engage, it's engage, 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 you know, you need to basically really say that and really mean it and really do it. And it is, some called it unkindly here, time for old dogs to learn new tricks. I think it's very clear that previously in the training that security specialists were given, they really weren't given the skills, you know, the knowledge and the soft skills of how you actually do that, right? And so in many organizations, we're still in this situation where, for instance, the developers go and try and hide when they're developing something new and great because they just think the security people are going to come and kill their baby, right? When, you know, arguably it would be much better to have that conversation early on and fix known problems rather than discover this like months and months down the road. So, and that this is the sort of thing we do in risks. We basically, there are, again, lots of things. So my colleague Lizzie Coles Kemp from Royal Holloway is one of the key leaders in this space, where they've been working with security experts and with people working in organizations. And, you know, it's basically not standing there and talking at people. It's going to people and say, tell me about your work. Tell me about, you know, how you work efficiently, and so that the security specialists can then learn how you fit things in. You know, don't go there and basically completely scare people with geek speak or sort of things. Start from what they know about and what they understand, and then bring your expertise to that. It's very, very, you know, they've also used cartooning techniques, and there's a lot of creative techniques on offer that can be, and they're available as computer-based tools that you can adapt to your own environment. And actually, the EU Trespass Project has been developing a whole range of tools. which are a great, you know, and this one is a great excuse to buy a whole shed load of serious Lego. As a way of actually sitting down with organizations and building these kind of, you know, these explanations of where the data is and how it's being protected and so on. And they can then stay afterwards in the environment to remind people why particular rules and particular precautions are in place and to remind them that if anything about the workflow changes, you may have to reconsider whether the risk management measures, the security measures are still working. So there's lots of good stuff going on. So to conclude, I want to summarize. So this security hygiene is essential. We really need to get rid of measures that really just disrupt people's activities, waste time, but are not leading to good risk management. The business leaders have to come in and do their bit, right? They can't basically argue it's all technical and they have no role to play. They need to give both their time and, of course, they need to give the right levels of investment to work with. I also think is that modern businesses really have to think beyond just getting staff to comply. You know, the attackers are constantly innovating. They're always looking for the weakest point. You need staff that are actually really engaged and willing to look out for anything unusual, to stand up and say if they see anything unusual, or to step in, you know, if they see a colleague, you know, who may be new or who may be a bit behind on their behavior change curve, if they see them doing something wrong, to actually step up and say, this is not how we do things around here, right? You know, we've agreed that from now, you know, we're basically following this procedure. And it is really amazing how sometimes even in very organizations where you think they've got a brilliant security culture and so, staff are very reluctant to step up and intervene when they see somebody else breaking the rules, right? Because they've not learned of how you do you, they've not been taught how to go and challenge somebody in a non-confrontational, neutral way. Right? And these are, again, these are things you can do in 30-minute lunch and learn sessions. You know, you can get people to do some role playing and practice that and, you know, and get that all out there. And that's also then everybody knows that it's okay to be challenged, right? You shouldn't react in an aggressive way if somebody challenges you about security. That's part of the healthy. So really, you can get help from other people in the organization. So I've recently worked with one organization where from the second meeting onwards, a lady came in and said, I'm from change management. I will be with you for the rest of this process, right? And she's basically, she knows how to identify enablers and blockers to change. She knows how to relate it to the overall business goals, to other things that are going on, and that can be tremendously helpful, right? You don't have to fight this by yourself. Similarly, as new people come in, if it's written in their contract that security is important, you know, that's part of the psychological contract that you do the right thing for security, that's enormously helpful in terms of moderating the behavior in the first place or to basically have the ammunition if you really get somebody, one of those rare numbers of people who really don't care and, you know, who just want to be left alone and think they can ignore it. You know, it basically gives you then good ammunition to for that person to be dealt with. So I hope that's given you some ideas of things to do in future. And my colleagues from the panel are now going to come up to comment and for us to discuss this further and answer your questions.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon. There we go. Very good. We're hoping to get Slido working to get your questions as we have our discussion and debate. So please do bring up the app and get your Slido login working and sending up your questions. We've got some already coming in. And you can also vote for which of those questions you think are the most relevant. We'll obviously try and include those. But first off, let's introduce our panel members. So I'm Stephen Bonner. I'm a partner at Deloitte. And I spent most of my career coming from a technical background, but then over the length of my career, realizing how critically important this culture and human elements are. So my role today is to moderate this panel and try and keep us from getting to fisticuffs on some of the more challenging views we'd have. So introducing the panel.
My name's Jonathan Kidd. I'm currently CISO at Hargreaves Lansdown. which is one of the UK's largest fund management platforms. Prior to that, I was CISO at the Met Office, the Meteorological Office, so I've got quite a different range of experience as a CISO there. And previously, I have been an auditor for a couple of years, but please don't hold that against me. So.
Very good.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Jessica Barker. My background before joining the cybersecurity profession was in sociology and urban regeneration, so I bring those perspectives to my work now. I've been working as a cybersecurity consultant for about the last 8 years, for the last 4 years running my own consultancy.
And we all know Angela from our excellent talk. So in that talk, several times you brought up the sort of concept of fear, that quite often in this profession we use fear to try and motivate either our senior management to get funding or our users to try and get them to get behaviour. The panellists, is fear effective as a motivator?
I mean, I don't think fear is an effective motivator at all, because quite often you get a huge amount of false positives. If you try and instill fear in your staff to not click any links, that makes them less effective. They'll start reporting things that are actually valid emails. You know, should I click on this, shouldn't I? And that's not good for any business.
So from my experience and from doing some research in the psychology of fear, I looked at public health, because of course there's a lot of use of fear appeals in the public health field, and some are successful, some aren't. So there's been a great deal of research that we can draw on from public health in terms of the psychology of fear. And the overwhelming message from that is, if you're going to talk about something scary, which inevitably we do in this industry, it's important to do it in a constructive way. So if you're talking about something scary, you need to make sure people understand how they are susceptible to that threat. And very important is to focus on the response that you're expecting, how it will mitigate the risk, and how that person is going to be able to engage with the response. So you need to give them the time, the resource, and a clear directive. So if you're going to talk, for example, about passwords and dangers with passwords, then you need to give them the solution, which I think ties into some points that Professor Sass was making, which is we can't just give people the problem, we need to tell them the solution we expect and how it works. And if we don't talk about scary things in that constructive way, people engage with the emotional response, they engage with the fear, and that's when you hear things like, hackers wouldn't want my data, why would anyone be interested in me, or the internet is so scary, I'm going to avoid it at all costs. And that's, I think, the state we're often in.
Yeah, I think there was a good example for that. If you go on YouTube and Google the devil's in your detail, there is a couple of TV spots that were produced a couple of years ago. And one of them is about giving out personal details, which is sort of like a guy on a park bench, which is quite okay. But the second one is actually in many ways an absolutely brilliant spot about a lady trying to do some shopping online, and then there is a guy, you know, sort of a grungy guy in a T-shirt in a basement. And in the course of this clip, all the jewelry, the clothes and everything migrate from this lady onto this guy, you know, because if it says, and at the end, if you don't take care of the details, you know, you're going to lose everything, kind of. And the result was, when they aired that spot, is that lots of people phoned up their banks and said, I don't want to do online banking anymore. Right, and that is of course not what you're trying to achieve. Yeah. We want all the benefits of the digital platforms and the digital engagement. And so people have to, if you just push too much on the fear, then people might not be confident in their ability to use those and then withdraw from it, as Jessica said. And that's really not what we want. You know, we want security that enables business and helps business to flourish, not get in the way of it.
I think in business as well, we make it quite difficult for staff, because on the one hand, they have no choice but because they've got a job and they need to do it. On the other hand, we tell them that if they don't obey this policy, it could be a disciplinary offence. And that puts them in a very difficult situation. They can't make the choice to not do this thing, but if they do it and they do it wrong, they could get sacked. So it's quite hard for staff to comply or to do things in the right way, because they're constantly second-guessing themselves.
I mean, it's quite interesting. We see in the sort of base of users within an organization, you get very different psychological attitudes. You get those who want to obey, will actually find you, read the policies, are interested in learning, really care about this topic, a small percentage, I'm sure. The most who just want to get on and do their job, and a few who have malicious intent and aren't interested or actually want to actively circumvent. And I'm interested to understand, how do you balance Because for some of those consequences, negative consequences may be an effective deterrent. If they know there may be disciplinary action, that may deter them from carrying out the malicious act. But the majority of people have no intent of doing that. It's just extra fear on them. How do you balance giving reward to those who are doing the right thing but punishing those who are doing the wrong thing in a way that actually gets them to engage? Do you have practical examples of how that might be done?
I think it's about it's about engagement in the first place, because I think if you are engaging all staff to be part of your culture, to identify any insider threat. And don't forget here, we're not talking just about deliberate malicious insiders. We could be have the unintentional insider. So somebody who their account details, for example, have been compromised by a malicious threat actor. And what you need to do is reward staff to help identify those things, to help train them what to look for, and help them to be aware that they can come and speak to you in confidence if they believe that anything's suspicious. It's not something that, you know, that they themselves have to actually point the person out and basically take them to account. They can come and speak to you from a kind of confidence point of view.
I think one simple thing you can do is reward good behaviours. So often we punish bad behaviours and we just ignore the good behaviours. So spear phishing exercises, which are quite popular, quite common in organisations now, an organisation will run it, they'll get the results back, and then they will punish or they will single out the people that clicked on the link in the spear phishing email, instead of singling out the people who didn't and saying, well done, and rewarding that positive behaviour. So too often we become the department or the profession that is telling people off rather than saying, that was a good job, well done.
Yes, I find that really effective. That's a really good example, because one of the things that we've moved towards doing is where staff do fall foul to an artificial phishing campaign, for example, we give them the option to acknowledge that and come to us, and then we can say to them, well done, that was great. You know, what did you spot about it, and can you spread that message amongst other people? And I think that makes them engaged and really understand why they're doing it.
I mean, we're seeing there's quite a lot of growth of that kind of phishing test. I think there's I see an interesting trend that in our world, many of the people in this profession have come from a more technical background without these skills, so they like to be able to measure things. They like a spreadsheet, they like some numbers, they like something sort of hard science they can hold on to. And I think this provides a veneer of that insight. It gives them some actual numbers they can track over time. How valuable do you think these services are for organisations?
I'm against them, totally and unequivocally. I think it's the wrong approach, because it's not really engaging users. It's not building the mindset. You know, what you actually want is to get this collaborative mindset, right? We're trying. You know, basically the bad guys are out here, out there. We are on the inside, are all working together to keep the organization secure. And we all have particular roles to play, and we all have particular responsibilities, right? And I think when you start attacking your own employees, you know, you undermine that kind of trust basis, and it just doesn't seem very constructive. So I really don't like doing it. And when I see, you know, basically what I try and help security experts to basically develop the skill of when they're seeing that somebody is not complying, instead of like going like, you know, stamping on it and stop doing it or whatever, and go back and say, why? Why are you doing that? And listen, first of all, be prepared to listen of why they're saying, and you will find, I mean, and what we've found in all the, you know, we've basically interviewed over 1,000 people in various organizations over the years. We've done surveys with tens of thousands of people who tell us, you know, I promise you 70 to 80% of the time they have a very good reason for it, right? Which may be that they were really just focused on the job and getting things done. And also because actually very often when the business leaders aren't really engaging with security and you're not really having that conversation, they're actually tacitly complicit with the staff prioritizing productivity over security, right? So they're basically, at the end of the day, they're weighing like, am I more likely to get sacked because I'm not producing, or am I more likely to get sacked because I'm not complying with security rules? And I would actually say is you're much more likely to get sacked because you're not producing, right? In most organizations, you don't get sacked for not complying unless that is directly linked to a security breach. And that is why, you know, people don't really take it seriously. right? So I think engaging, find it out, and then basically find, you know, and we basically call it shadow security. Often you find when people are not doing what you want them to do, they're still actually managing the risk in the best way they know. You know, they go like, ooh, you know, basically my colleague needs a document out of the access control system. They haven't got the permissions, but I can see they really need it, or we might lose this customer. I'll get it out for them. I'll give it to them or email it to them, but I'll password protect it, right? So it's not they're completely like, you know, out of my way, you know, and, you know, I'll throw it. But they don't quite understand all the risks. But it's then important to have that conversation about, you know, and sometimes the best way to get compliance is to do things like upgrade your IT infrastructure, right? I would quite confidently say from my observations, half of security problems are down to crap IT. Right, and instead of basically spending, thank you, yeah, instead of spending more money on security sticky plaster, go and refresh, you know, your infrastructure. Be better. Think about, you know, that maybe investing a bit earlier in the next generation sort of infrastructure. Get that sorted out. You know, a lot of those problems, once you start digging, you actually find it's really not the individual's fault. They are just trying to make the best out of a bad situation they're being put in. No, and they often, if you talk to them, is, you know, they can tell you what they think is doable in the context of the particular job they do, you know, and think about it as, okay, if that's something they can do, let's, you know, see whether we can secure it, right? You know, I mean, it's a bit like Facebook going and securing and encrypting all of WhatsApp, right? I mean, you know, it's something that people want to use to communicate, right? That's something they're happy with. It works for them. Okay, let's make that secure. Keep that in mind. You know, I think you'll find a lot of other solutions you can come up that are parallel to that.
I totally agree with that, because people just have jobs to do and they want to do the job, and they're usually engaged with the firm they work for. They've got a primary task about that firm, and they want to do that well, and then we come along and say, no, you can't do that. And I think what we should be saying to them is, okay, well, what are you trying to achieve, and let me help you do that securely. Yes. But we've got a long history of InfoSec professionals sitting at desk, sending emails, ringing people and saying, no, don't do that.
Now, looking to the Slido for a moment, one of the sort of slightly reinterpreting the first question there, when I look back over my early days in security, there were two things we told our users. Set a strong password and look for the padlock. That was always about look for the padlock. And I think it's been quite fascinating. Over the last year, as an industry, we spent a lot of effort on making sure everybody has access to certificates to encrypt their capability to try and reduce those number of warnings about certificates, which of course has meant the malware has been able to gain access to certificates and encrypt theirs. So now increasingly the phishing sites have perfectly good padlocks on them to guarantee they're completely safe to the users. And the other message was pick these strong passwords that we've heard now is not the message we're sending to them. So in a world where we've put a lot of time and effort, perhaps mostly ineffectively, to convince people of certain key behaviors or things they know are certainly true about this topic, when we arrive and change that message, when we evolve and use science and the evidence we have to actually tune that, quite often the response is not embracing the change, but sort of rejecting the value that we're adding because we're seen as not having a clear idea, having been wrong before, why can we trust that we're right this time? So how do you communicate a challenging new message that's sort of a contradiction of everything you've potentially been communicating to that point?
I think it's difficult because we often focus on telling people what to do. So we often focus on look for this, or this is the thing you need to do. You need to have a secure password. You need to look for the padlock. You need to engage in these behaviors, when we need to kind of go deeper than that and talk more about the mindset. And then to say, you know, this field is very evolving. It is going to change. Messages and core behaviors that we recommend are going to change year on year. But we see that happen in science, and we see science contradict itself, and we move on and acknowledge that our knowledge has progressed. And so I think it's the same in this industry. It's saying, yes, that was right for that time, but the internet has changed, the attackers have evolved, we need to evolve as well.
I mean, it's really no different in the physical world, that, you know, basically people there accept that if, you know, if your environment changes, you know, if suddenly somebody puts a big, you know, a big fast road, you know, through your immediate neighborhood, that you would change your behavior, and what you tell your children will change. And I think, you know, it's sort of just saying to people, like, you know, more and more of what we do is online, and the online environment, unfortunately, it is not stable. It is evolving all the time. And that's why I think it's so important to actually not just say, do this, do that, and then, you know, the basically one-way communication, but to engage, you know, to just basically say that really, if we want to protect ourselves, we need to talk about the risks out there. We need to talk about the challenges that we're facing, and they will change, you know, and we need to be aware of, we need to be aware of those. And I think you will almost get to the point where in organizations in future, you'll have, like, you know, that it will become routine for people to check the security update of the day as you come in, you know, as to what's been happening and what, you know, basically what's changed from before. Mm.
Yeah. We've spoken a lot about affecting the users and the customers. One of the things I note is that the culture within security teams themselves and the people who are drawn to this profession is not perhaps entirely representative of the broader audience. Can we talk a little bit about why you think that is and what we can do? Do we need to change that? And if we do, how can we improve that?
Is this, I mean, I guess you're referring here to the kind of old way of doing security, which is very compliance-based, very controls-based, with little engagement with the business in terms of what they're trying to achieve.
I think I see that quite often, yeah.
I think we definitely need to change that because that doesn't really have a place anymore. Just mentioned, threat actors change their techniques very rapidly. They collaborate. They're prepared to try new and interesting things on a regular basis. And if we keep telling our staff in a very regimented way, if you do these 10 things, then we'll be okay. And then we don't look very good, and we're not doing a good job of protecting our organizations. So I think, again, it's about encouraging and helping some people in our teams to get out there and go and sit with the business and understand what they do. One of the things that I found very effective in previous roles, where we've had a particularly challenging part of the organization where there's a completely opposite mindset to security, absolutely opposed in the kind of way that they like to do things, are putting people into placements in that part of the business. Just saying, go and work with them for a couple of weeks, find out what they do, speak to them, find out what they're trying to achieve, and then see if you can help them do that in a better way. And that works well because, first of all, it makes InfoSec analysts go out and speak to people, which is good, and also it helps them absorb new knowledge.
So the SANS Securing the Human Awareness Report is interesting in this. The most recent version has just been published, but one thing they have looked at is the background of information security professionals who are delivering awareness-raising training. And what they have found is the vast majority come from an IT or a technical background, which is fantastic for having the knowledge that you need to transfer, but, and Angela touched on this very nicely in her presentation, but not necessarily having the skills as to how to communicate it. So they may know what to say, but not how to say it in a way that it will be engaging and people will listen. So when I do this kind of conference presentation, when I talk to people who are responsible for awareness raising, I will say, you know, do you have a program of awareness raising training for your users in your organization? And pretty much everyone puts their hand up and says yes. And then I will ask, do you have any kind of training for the technologists? So are you, as an IT professional or an information security professional, are you trained in the users? Are you ever trained in the human side of things? And of course, the answer is always no. Nobody gets that kind of support. So organizations are expecting technical teams and technical professionals to change behavior without giving them any support in understanding how to change behavior. And I was very flattered, the NCSE at the Cyber UK conference, they quoted me in having said that. And I think it's fantastic that we have a socio-technical department in the NCSE that are looking at the issues that Angela's also been looking at and trying to drive that understanding in the security professional. Because we talk about it being people, process, and technology, but so often we pay lip service to that and we focus on the technology and not the people or the process.
And I think there's a strong collaboration message there as well, because sometimes, no matter how hard you try, you will have people who just want to do the security job. They don't want to go out and talk to people. They don't want to go out and engage in that way. And that's where collaboration with other parts of the organization that do it on a daily basis, that do training and awareness, and that's their role, can really, really help.
Yeah.
The key issue there is trying to get them to understand the security messages that you're trying to get across.
Yes, it's that two-way conversation that so often doesn't happen in organizations, so siloed, whereas if you can get HR, communication, marketing together and looking at this problem, I think that's hugely beneficial.
Turning to the slide a moment, we have a question at the top now. Do we need to change recognized standards such as ISO 27001 and PCI DSS?
I think 27001 does have flexibility in it. You know, it's risk-based. You have a bit of flexibility as an organization about how you can approach that. PCI DSS, definitely with regards to the way that we approach that. I think as organizations, PCI DSS can be one of the things that's seen as a, we've got to get through this, and then we're okay. I think we need to work closer with the external auditors for organizations that are subject to that standard to help them understand how we're applying that and how that works for our organization. And that's where things like the passwords, you know, that's really where that's a really difficult sell, because you might have a QSA who's very, very, very fixed on that's not the right thing to do. And then you have to convince them of why it is. And then obviously the standard itself could be an issue there. So I think we have a bit of a way to go with regards to some of the compliance standards.
I think they do need to change, and they need to have this notion of whether the prescribed solution is actually doable needs to go into the standards, right? So there should be an accounting for how much time and effort this would take, and whether a test has been conducted to make sure that the people who are supposed to do it can actually do it, right? And I think that would make an enormous difference, you know, because we've seen it in so many things, you know, that if you basically enforce certain things in the name of security but that aren't workable, you end up with weaker actual security as a result. You know, you basically force strong and long passwords and people just make them simpler. You know, the more you expire them, the more guessable passwords become and so on. And so basically doing that, you know, getting it, and it's actually interesting, there is some definition going, some discussion going on within ISO whether there should be a definition of usable security, which would mean there should be a test for what's basically workable. And I think that would be very good. You know, and I would see, I mean, the number of times it's like, you know, I get to like ply, you know, crawl through all the dirty laundry. And the amount of time I've seen organizations really, you know, particularly small and medium-sized businesses, just to change their whole setup for the PCI DSS audit and then promptly dismantle it afterwards, you know, is, you know, I mean, this is wasted effort that should be put to solutions that actually work. So
I mean, it is counterproductive. I mean, many years ago in a previous consultancy role, one of the questions you'd always get asked by companies, so what do I have to do with PCI DSS? Can I not just segment everything off there and just do something completely different for that a little bit? And you'd say, well, you could do that, but really you want to kind of try and encourage some of the good things into the rest of the business.
Yes.
They always segmented off the PCI DSS infrastructure. It's not, you know, it's not unnecessarily a great standard.
You touched on sort of testing there and seeing the impact. In other fields like web design, there's a lot of effort around sort of A/B testing and constantly measuring and seeing what works and what doesn't. Why do you think as in security we don't seem to have that mindset of actually running comparative tests to see if controls are efficient and also effective in what they do?
I think because we've come from the point of view of what we want. We come from this idea of this is how it should look and it should be perfect and this is our idea. And we haven't come from the point of view of people. So we've made it very security centric and not, and we've thought this is the control we're going to put in place and this is going to be the outcome. And we don't think that maybe people won't respond in the way we expect. So because we haven't had that people centric response, we've just thought we can enforce this policy, we can put it in place, people will follow it, it'll be great. And if they don't, well, then it's their fault. Goes back to your slides earlier. Whereas if we came from a more people-centric approach, then we would think, okay, we need to test out because people aren't going to respond necessarily how we in our perfect world are imagining it. That's my perspective on that.
I think for years we have had an approach of looking at people as being a compliance unit, something that will just obey the controls if we really shout hard enough. And then if they don't, I've seen InfoSec teams get quite depressed and say, well, security would be great if only they would do this, or if only that team, the rest of the organization can do it, why can't that team do it? And I think we really need to understand more about, you know, what kind of things the organization is trying to achieve. And they just become a lot more risk-based.
It, part of it can also be, basically, we shouldn't trivialize the amount. Basically, if you do metrics, you have to resource the metrics as well, right? And there is a bit of an attitude in some organizations like, basically, rather than doing metrics, I just spend it on some security, like some minister in the Home Office 20 years ago who, when they introduced all the CCTV cameras in public spaces, right? And that there was in the plan, there was basically money for an evaluation study to follow up on the effectiveness of these CCTV measures. And the minister just went like, what do we need money for research for, right? We know the stuff, forget the study, just buy more cameras with the money, right? And that kind of attitude you sometimes also get in organizations and also because there, because I think it is if the people at the top of the organization don't actually ask for the metrics and evidence,